Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Queen in Her Circle by Helen Cathcart, narrated by Lorna Bennett. 1. The Queen's Room. 1. When the Queen is away, her sitting room at Buckingham Palace holds the quiescent, expectant atmosphere with which imagination may endow all much-used rooms, the Scottish intent to bide a while when awaiting the mistress of the house. In her absence, first impressions must be of the light from the wide bow window, a daylight of northern clarity, diffused by the transparent inner curtains. There is, besides, an unanticipated rural serenity, heightened by the chirp of cockney sparrows and the green glimmer of the trees that cushion the tourist hubbub of Constitution Hill. Within that broad bow window, a lofty arc of 5 double casements, the Queen's writing table stands sidelong to the room, a handsome pedestal desk of the late 18th century, neither massive nor overwide, not an opulent city desk, but Chippendale, perhaps, in his plainer mode, the wood dark and lustrous, the reeded corners softened by ovals of inlaid satinwood, more in Hepplewhite style, that endow it with a pleasantly feminine quality. It is the selfsame desk which the Queen used long ago, when, as Princess Elizabeth, she lived at Clarence House. Although flanked these many years by a sofa table, bearing its incessant daily burden of red leather dispatch boxes, more than the gilt and brocaded throne in the throne room, not 100 paces distant, this writing table is the functional centre of the monarchy and, whenever the Queen is present, her sitting room is the focus of all that connotes to the crown. The room is of pleasant proportions, some 33 feet by 20. The architect, John Nash, intended it as one of the finest of all the private apartments designed for George IV. The Queen knew it in distant childhood as her grandmother's sitting room, and later as her mother's drawing room.
"Our dear old rooms," her great-grandmother, Queen Alexandra, had written long ago on relinquishing Buckingham Palace to King George V and Queen Mary. "I shall be very curious to see how you have arranged them all. Yes, the sitting room with its nice and pretty bow window is certainly very cold and draughty in the winter, particularly where my writing table stood." Earlier still, it had been the Prince Consort's working room, and in her heavenly Elysium, Queen Victoria may well smile at the continuity of her great-great-granddaughter working in dear Albert's room more than a century later. The draughts were banished long since by shortening the formerly tall French windows to give convector space beneath the sills, and Albert's heavily gilded and coffered ceiling was masked by crisp modern plaster. Yet for 7 years after her accession, the present Queen used the room as her study and sitting room, much as it had been decorated for Queen Mary in 1910. There remains the graceful white marble Georgian chimneypiece, the same white-painted dado. The walls, however, are no longer fussed by gilt mouldings and baroque swags. The Queen wished the scheme simplified, and a more restful effect was gained by aquamarine wallpaper of delicate brocade pattern above the chair rail, creating the plainer, restrained, and domestic atmosphere more acceptable to modern taste. At the same time, a favourite carpet was brought out of store, a modern self-coloured Chinese carpet of palest gold, softly patterned with flowers of the same light tone. As Edward Halliday's painting, Conversation Piece, Clarence House, suggests, it had fitted Princess Elizabeth's first sitting room almost exactly, and now was equally found to suit the Queen's study. Through 25 years of change, the room, used as both sitting room and study, has become more youthful and congenial in character. Floor-to-ceiling curtains of an old-fashioned brocade have been replaced by elephant grey velvet, and in summer these are hung at times with their pale linings to the room to create a lighter, cooler effect. In a fanciful mood, in the Queen's absence, we might wish to stand there and memorize each detail, but the exercise would be unsatisfying. When the Queen is away, dust covers create their formless landscape and drugget covers the floor. The desk itself is left an anonymous bulk. Paintings are apt to be removed for skilled attention, the chairs sheeted, the door handles bagged, and the Waterford chandelier is periodically lowered and washed, the dozen pale yellow lampshades cleaned. During a long royal absence, the room waits in this bleak disarray, with its memories of the stuff of history, framed as history so often is in transient everyday events. The heart of monarchy is always with the Queen. At Windsor Castle, a seat of the reigning house for 1,000 years, a more splendid Chippendale writing table stands sidelong within a bay window. This was her father's desk, a wedding gift from his father, George V. Elsewhere in her private rooms, convenient for personal correspondence, is the smaller desk subscribed for her 30 years ago by the people of Berkshire. On the adjacent marble-topped console, painted models of Ascot postillions serve as bookends, and the most conspicuous painting is of the Queen's great racehorse, Oriole. In contrast, the private sitting room and study aboard the Royal Yacht Britannia is streamlined to essentials, a traveller's home from home. The built-in desk in the clean lines of Gordon Russell, a plain-covered settee against the opposite wall, a low teak table or two where books lie about, and the one lush highlight, a mirror ornamented by the signs of the zodiac on the bulkhead above the electric fire. At Balmoral, the Queen's altogether smaller writing table, one of the least cluttered in royal use, fits into the pine bay window of her private room, overlooking the rose garden and the western view of pasture and pine woods. At the Queen's right hand, a sun-bleached, baize-topped table bears a changing traffic of papers and holiday jigsaw puzzles. Her chair of polished pine cushioned with a chintz of faded rose, pale tartan is reserved for the floor. The sun stains and fades everywhere, and in the background is the continuous rush and ripple of the Dee. But the Queen's study, her habitual living room, in that northern suite of the private rooms in Buckingham Palace, more frequently frames the ultimate fiat of state business, apart from the meetings of the Privy Council. An impressive distinction is maintained between the private study and the Queen's audience room, a few steps along the corridor, where cabinet ministers receive their seals of office, and the British Prime Minister is officially received every Tuesday evening. The Queen usually carries her handbag to the audience room. It is farther still, a corridor, a lift and a corridor again, to the Bow Room, or the 1844 room, where by custom she receives ambassadors. The audience room is not so aloof that drinks are never served there, but few memoirs describe the intimacy of the study. Besides, if the Queen were at home and you should be invited to her sitting room, who but her closest intimates would wish to divide attention from the Queen herself to note mere furnishings? 2. At a friend's fireside, one is aware of the familiar setting as a tangible embroidery to their lives, full of evidence of character. There is a legend that the Queen's grandfather, King George V, had his rooms photographed so that the housekeeper should have a permanent record of where everything unchangeably stood, from his armchair to his inkpots. That wouldn't do today. Things are being changed around so often, smiles a member of the present-day household. That complex mesh of the various secretaries and officials of the Queen's working existence. A painting goes on loan for an exhibition, and the Queen chooses the substitute or an old memento reappears to please a forthcoming visitor. Besides, the Queen likes to switch pictures around before they form shadows. Or the over-accustomed eye takes them for granted. gifts brought back from an overseas tour, or souvenirs of an engagement nearer home, remain in view for a while, as if yielding a secret stimulus. Yet in the midst of the continuous shuffle and change of scene, the royal staff recognise an unvarying stability. At her London desk, the Queen still uses the mahogany Chippendale elbow chair her father gave her in her teens, with only the embroidered seating renewed from time to time. Near at hand, a painted Sheraton armchair of Pompeian taste supports an ever-changing pile of papers, books and magazines. Again, beyond the far window corner of the desk, there rises a small tiered bookstand, topped by a single drawer, on which a radio clock and a typed card of the day's engagements jostle a gold-framed miniature of an 18th-century Countess of Strathmore, as if in constant reminder of that lesser side of ancestry. From the drawer knobs, too, hang small calendars of the illustrated kind found in any cottage, one evidently to represent all the small fry who thus solve their Christmas gift problem for Aunt Lilibet, the other perhaps a symbol of all the unknown children, and there are thousands, who enjoy the magic of writing a letter to the Queen. Within the confines of the two telephones to the left, the sofa table to the right, the desk is cluttered, but not disordered. The Queen is well systemised, said her former private secretary, Sir Michael Adeen. Time-saving is typified by the intercom console, tucked to the left, within the crowded space of the window. Probably the pottery bowl on its top was made by Prince Charles at Gordonston, and intended for fruit. One's mother must keep her strength up, though long since enlisted in turn for its daily consignment of notebooks, cards, and private correspondence. When first shown around Osborne, the present author stepped closer to examine the photographs and relics on Queen Victoria's desk, and bells rang, attendants rushed from everywhere, and my smiling mentor demonstrated how I had inadvertently sounded the alarm. Curious eyes do not roam over Queen Elizabeth II's writing table. The accustomed secretary takes in an habitual impression of the working material, the low box of triple-stacked stationery, and the bank of family photographs, the waiting wad of typed documents and well-filed folders, the pack of parliamentary white papers, the government-issue notebook and notepads. The centrepiece of the leather blotter keeps company with the sponge in its glass pot, a batch of pens, pencils, ballpoints, sealing wax, scissors, paste pot, a small silver tray of oddments, a painted tray for in-and-out correspondence and, more recently, the Alaskan jade and gold paperweight presented when Elizabeth II inaugurated the flow of North Sea oil. When the Queen is away for more than a few days, everything personal safely vanishes into a satinwood chest of drawers. When she is at home in the palace, her room blossoms with flowers, ever-changing ceremonial bouquets from Commonwealth governments, smaller personal tributes from friends. Even daffodils or hyacinths in a beribboned garden pot. The Queen's personal friends, the closer members of the household, the more intimate domestic staff alone see the room truly through everyday eyes. The desk may be congested, its attendant wicker baskets never far away, but over the rest hangs a carefree, deceptive air of muddle.
"I like it if my rooms look really lived in," the Queen asserts.
In setting down his own impressions, a former personal footman once noted, possibly with some exaggeration, that the room appeared as if a bomb had devastated it. Books, magazines, and other things lying about. I had to tidy up and then carefully put everything back to restore her disorder. Otherwise the Queen would be sure to ask, "Where have you hidden so-and-so? Please, what have you done with this or that?" Richard Crossman similarly wrote of seeing the Queen in a dim, horrible little room with a picture of her corgi over her writing table.
Her study alone has a painting of her old favourite dog, Susan, who rode in her carriage on her wedding day, ancestor of many royal corgis. It was a drear February day, and the Queen may not have switched on the lights, but dim and horrible. There's no accounting for impressions. From the chintzy grey and pink-striped sofa and armchairs to the satinwood side tables, a friend might reflect that the warmly familiar old room changes very little. Pompeian or Etruscan, the painted Sheraton chair in the window is one of a set of seven. Two others flank a satinwood chest. The 26-inch television stands in its accustomed place against a screen of red and blue tapestry, the receiver itself a slightly outdated model. Above all, a yard or two to the left of the fireplace, there stands the choicest kingpin of the household gods. This is the Queen's superbly beautiful Heppel-white mahogany breakfront bookcase, containing behind the lozenged glazing not only books, but also an assembly of smaller personal treasures. And prominent on the breakfront shelf stands the framed last photograph of her father, and beside it, one of her favourite photographs of four-year-old Prince Charles with the King. The displayed contents are changed imperceptibly, no doubt with more keepsakes and objets d'art stowed in the drawers and cupboards below. An ancient Grecian mask yields place to a Fabergé spray of buttercups, Doris Lindner's porcelain model of Princess Anne, taking offence with her horse doublet, is positioned to match a silver equestrian figure of a guardsman. Two or three racing trophies flank the small rose quartz Buddha that once belonged to Queen Mary. Figurines from Denmark and Germany, the gifts of state visits, and other tokens of regard or loyalty are there, each remindful of occasions and of friendship. The bookcase was once a dominant feature of the Queen's sitting room at Clarence House. It had been a joint wedding gift from all the outer cousinly members of her family, from the King of Norway and the Milford Havens, the old Princess Helena Victoria and Marie Louise, the young princes of Gloucester and Kent, and many more. Among them old kinsfolk long since gone, and others who were not then in their teens. 40 relatives and more affectionately subscribe to this wedding present, and so the bookcase shelters an inner significance unknown to the outside world. Crested and ornamented, richly surfaced, and yet of classic simplicity, the bookcase becomes less one of the splendid treasures of a sovereign queen than the cherished possession of a young wife who created her first married home with love, and within 3 years had to relinquish it for the north wing of a palace and the painful road of lifelong duty. The contents of the room are a bride's furnishings, courageously reassembled to repair the awful circumstance of her father's early death and the sudden knell of her own youthful destiny. The Queen's desk was itself a wedding gift, almost certainly the one subscribed in shillings and school pennies by the kindly and affectionate people of Windsor, a symbol now of the workaday link between Windsor Castle and her capital. The set of terracotta-painted Sheraton chairs, together with their matching love seats, were the bridal gift of the City of London. These are possessions that signal their daily reassurance, the cabinets and chests no less intimate than the bookstand given by Princess Elizabeth's first lady-in-waiting, the Pembroke table from old family friends, the table lamps created, in the post-war fashion, from Chinese porcelain vases, one given by the Queen's favourite Aunt Rose, and another from her close friends, the Nevilles. The pair of red wattled porcelain cockerels guarding either side of the mantel shelf are lightly known as Martin's chickens, being two out of four Qian Lung figures forming a wedding gift to which the Queen's private secretary, Sir Martin Charteris, had contributed through his army regiment. The tapestry screen was itself a wedding gift from Queen Mary, the secretive satinwood chest of drawers, a joint presentation of the 12 great city guilds,
and thus a link with centuries of civic history. And these are but a few of the remindful tokens that everywhere surround the Queen in her daily work. They are personal accessories rather than heirlooms, sustaining more affection to their present owner than all her treasures handed down from a more distant past. This is the room, then, at the centre of a modern monarchy, the tangible hub of the Queen's own world, in her individual circle of constancy. 2. The Queen in Private. 1. Millions in their mind's eye know that small, upright figure at the desk. Many in imagination picture the Queen as she goes about her daily tasks, and few are acquainted with the true personality of the woman herself. At the centre of the celebrations of her 25 years on the throne, after the Jubilee surfeit of newsprint, what more can we know of her? After all her travels around the world in the cause of an ideal. The Silver Jubilee saw her widely applauded for her dedicated and highly professional attitude to her career. Yet phrases become stereotyped in describing the Queen. She remains closer to the world realities of government and appears closer to her people, through television, radio, and travel, than any other monarch who has ever reigned. She has acquainted herself, so far as humanly possible, with every fact of national and commonwealth life and with the hearts and minds of people of every race. Those about Queen Elizabeth II know her in every mood, her serious, intent, reflective frame of mind, when she can still surprise her colleagues with her perceptive questions, her ready chuckle and her smiling happiness when her head flings back in uninhibited mirth. "There's a lot of laughter in this house," said a former secretary, while I was writing my first book on the Queen, then in her early 30s. Inevitably the laughter, though not her cheerfulness nor ready gaiety, has diminished as it does for us all with the passage of time. Yet the impulsive storms and harsher trends have quietened also. The Queen, when annoyed, knows the stern glance that can reprove an offender. Her public image is not so very different from the truth. She undertakes her duties with a measure of the relaxed contentment which friends long since recognised in her mother, yet with a meticulous attention to detail, more reminiscent of her father's temperament. She has come to expect respectful candour from her household staff. She does not dissemble readily, and the wish to celebrate her silver jubilee posed a question. Queen Victoria had waited 50 years before deciding to celebrate, sustained through many great trials and sorrows. As she wrote in her journal, the one irrefutable precedent was that Elizabeth's grandfather, King George V, had celebrated his 25 years, as he had noted, on a glorious summer day, surprised by the greatest number of people in the streets that I have ever seen. Although many people felt at the time that the rejoicings were more for his supposed return to health than in measuring a difficult reign marked by war and lengthening industrial depression. In announcing her government's decision that the occasion should be celebrated, the Home Secretary was at pains to stress her chief anxiety, namely, that there should be no undue expenditure. It was a more private difficulty that the day of her father's death had always been observed by his widow with a religious family service. As so often, the Queen marked the anniversary in attending morning service at the little brick-built Chapel of All Saints in the private grounds of Royal Lodge, where the King had usually worshipped. Her own Jubilee service of Thanksgiving in St. Paul's Cathedral would come later. In the event, the avalanche of media tributes that weekend did not take her unaware. The compliments could be modestly taken with a grain of salt. It was more pleasing that the solid virtues of the institution of monarchy were widely reviewed by busy contemporary pens and not found wanting. The harsher bias of a BBC panorama programme aroused resentment and appeared a discordant minority view. More usually,
Any slur that might diminish the lustre of crown and constitution can deeply arouse the Queen to indignation.
Is there anything in it?
She will ask her closer intimates when noting a criticism. Opinions are canvassed and judicially considered. If the court appears to move with the times, it is often because the Queen herself has kept watch and instituted points of reform. 2. Myths and misapprehension have always surrounded kings and queens, and it was notably a sign of the times that among the Jubilee commentators, few stressed the loneliness that may hedge the throne. Possibly this was because the viewpoint is no longer widely accepted. 40 relatives amiably ready to subscribe to a wedding present and clubbing more recently for a silver wedding gift would not suggest tangible loneliness to many of us. Death exacts its gradual toll as the Queen grows older, but the family group strengthens. As her father once said, with additions, of course, at suitable moments. When Elizabeth came to the throne, her cousin, Princess Alexandra, was still a child aged only 15, her Gloucester cousins 10 and 7, her own two younger sons unborn, her nephew and niece, Princess Margaret's children, scarcely contemplated in the shadowy future. Many of her friendships, pleasant as they were, remained at a Debbie immature level, so fully did Prince Philip fill her whole horizon. On her accession, the Queen had hardly begun to appreciate or to realign all the social complexities of her wider royal family, the innumerable separate friendships fostered under her mother's influence, the many human ties strengthened through her husband. In that indispensable annual, Whitaker's Almanac, the sections on the Queen's household, the peerage, the orders of chivalry, the British Constitution, are among the few headings in Old English type, as if the archaic black lettering serves to emphasise ancient tradition. The idle reader may conjure up a procession of a private secretary, the deputy private secretary, and the assistant private secretary, bearing their parchment documents on velvet cushions. The reality, of course, is of busy men of proved experience in an echelon of upper executives in personal and exacting service to the sovereign, working associates of an average score of years standing, with whom the Queen is on terms of all but total informality and friendship. In personal conversation, with the Queen as with each other, they are Martin, Philip, Bill, Ron, their ma'am, to the Queen used as if it were her name. It is Martin who attends to state and cabinet business, and on summer evenings sometimes works with mallet and chisel in a studio in the garden of St. James's Palace, immersed in his hobby of sculpture. It is Philip and Bill who iron out some complex tangle of an overseas tour and handle the day-to-day correspondence of engagements. It is Oliver who marks up the Queen's art sales catalogues, and the Queen takes an altogether kind and sympathetic interest in Ron's problems with his teenage family. With her astonishingly retentive memory, the Queen knows, remembers, and is often involved with the personal concerns of not only her household officials and secretaries, but also with a number of her domestic staff, many of whom come to regard themselves as a close-knit part of a family group, almost Edwardian in its warm attachments and high standards. Utterly alone in itself, the exalted position of the sovereign may always be, but when the investiture chairs are stacked away or the round-table luncheon guests have left, the Queen often feels a need for solitude and takes a stroll by herself in the palace gardens, with her scurry of corgis. Monday especially may bring a brief respite, enabling her to commence the week riding with perhaps only one companion through the woods and glades of Windsor Great Park. The occasional necessity of isolation, of insulation from overmuch companionship, carries revealing trace elements. When the Queen and Prince Philip set about modernising the guest suites at Windsor Castle some years ago, they both thought it an admirable opportunity to
to grace the contemporary furnishings with equivalent paintings of our own time and age.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?